Let me tell you about a product that I am using personally, and I really think this works. You know, beetroot juice has been used by Olympic athletes for its stamina-boosting effects, and studies show that it can increase athletic performance and stamina by 16%. So call 800-738-2198 or go to intelligentbeets.com, and you can get a 30-day supply free of this great product. It comes with your first order, and it's backed by a money-back guarantee. 800-738-2198. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, it is time for our weekly feature that you seem to appreciate so much because we get so much great feedback, our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein you get to pose your questions. You never know what you're going to hear. That's part of the excitement. Is it could be a condition that you or a loved one suffer from, or a medical or nutritional concern that you have, and there you will have an answer. You can email us your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com. And now joining us is Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin, a celebrity in her own right, because, well, a lot of people, you know, feel up close and personal with Layla because they visit with her every week here on this feature. How you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman, how are you?
And I might add, for those of you unfamiliar with this podcast, Layla is a registered dietitian, as well as the recipient of a master's degree in the field of nutrition. And together we work on patient problems at the Hoffman Center using a team approach. So let's apply that team approach to some of these questions. Any big news this week? Anything in the news that struck you in the
warmer
medical news?
Warmer weather in the medical news?
Warmer weather, yes, indeed.
I'm very excited about warmer weather.
Yes, we're all very excited about warmer weather.
Medical news?
We're emerging from a deep, dark, cold, hunger winter here in the Northeast. And, you know, it's amazing because this is what, you know, I grew up in Southern California, and this kind of weather that we're experiencing would be considered like a deep freeze.
Yeah.
Weather in the 40s. But for New Yorkers, they're exultant. I saw a gal walking down the street. She was wearing shorts and a muscle shirt.
You know? She was coming back from the gym.
I think she was rocking the warm temperatures.
40s is great.
Yeah. So, anyway. And so yeah, what struck me in the news this week was an interesting story that was actually reported widely in the medical press. Didn't get very much coverage in the mainstream news, possibly for good reason. I think there's a little bit of a pro-pharmaceutical bias in the mainstream media, because this is a story that has a vast amount of impact for the tens of millions of Americans who've been convinced to go on statin drugs.
Oh.
And, you know, I think there's a place for statin drugs. Some people require them, probably far
fewer. People who've had heart attacks.
People who've had heart attacks, possibly people who've had strokes, people who've had stents put in, or people who have new artificial arteries and veins put in, people who've had bypass surgery. It turns out that it may take 50 or 60 years to ruin a pair of God-given arteries, but when you bypass, the arteries go a lot faster. The average duration before closing up again in a coronary bypass is more like 10 or 15 years, and sometimes less, tragically.
Sometimes less,
people go through that arduous surgery, and again, they get closure.
That's in my family.
Yeah, so the bypass buys them a little time, but these are people who really have a lot of cardiovascular risk, and perhaps statins may confer some protection. All right, so, but at a price, because a new study suggests that there is, so far, the highest to date recorded risk for diabetes in patients who take statin drugs. This is already recognized. There's actually a label warning on statin drugs that while they, you know, can reduce cardiovascular risk, so they say, they increase your risk for type 2 diabetes. They actually help, they decompensate your blood sugar control to the tune of, at first they thought it was 20%, but in this new study, 43%. A greater susceptibility to diabetes in those taking. I'm not saying that 43% of people who take statins get diabetes, but in the natural course of things, if you didn't take a statin, you'd have a 43% lower chance of developing diabetes.
Wow.
That's very significant.
Couple that with a cardiac prudent diet, which a lot of doctors, cardiologists especially, are still espousing a low-fat diet.
I'm doing my Dr. Evil quotation marks here. The so-called prudent diet, right?
Right. That'll bring you to diabetes, too.
Right. The diet rich
double
in
whammy.
Getting rid of saturated fats, having lots of polyunsaturated oils.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll come back to that in a second because I've
got eating lots of grains, lots of them.
And make sure that you have a lot of whole grains. Okay, yeah. So the other and even scarier part of this is that in this study, they've actually hypothesized that statins, because they protect the heart, they will protect the brain. They thought, well, you know, we'd love to show that by taking a statin, not only do you protect your heart, but you protect your brain. And, okay, like, it could make sense because, you know, if indeed it protects the circulation, maybe, I mean, just like how medical hypotheses get formulated. Is that
like the carotid artery, maybe, but
exactly.
Not the brain itself.
Well, okay, so, but let's go with that hypothesis. Maybe, just maybe, the statins could protect your brain because we see this terrible legacy of brain disorders, Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease and neurodegenerative conditions. So they hypothesized that it might protect against Parkinson's disease. And actually, this study that discovered the higher risk of diabetes was aimed at looking at Parkinson's disease prevention.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, they found that there was no Parkinson's disease prevention by taking statins. In fact, there was a higher risk of Parkinson's disease in patients taking statins. Which kind of makes sense.
It does, because with our Parkinson's patients, I know that you prescribe loads of CoQ10 for them.
Loads of CoQ10.
And that's one of the things that statins deplete.
Exactly. So it precisely interferes with something that's so important for mitochondrial function in the brain, which we know is impaired in many brain disorders. So that's number one. And after all, the brain is made of cholesterol, and, you know, great, you come back with a cholesterol of 99 on your blood test. But what is that might mean a benefit for your heart, maybe, but it might also mean...
But not for your mood.
But not for your mood, and not for your brain, which is, you know, we're all fatheads. Our brains are loaded with cholesterol. And, you know, when you deplete the cholesterol, maybe that you get a desiccated brain, you know. So that totally makes sense. And, you know, I saw that coming. I'm glad they finally did the study.
Wow.
It's the truth is out. And I put it up on Facebook, and there's like over 2,000 people who've interacted with that article, shared it, or
terrific. Spread the word.
Yeah, so that the word is getting out. A certain amount of statin skepticism is warranted. Okay, one more thing.
Mm-hmm.
On the polyunsaturated oil front. Do you know what the major polyunsaturated oil that people consume is? I think as a dietitian you might know that.
Either canola or corn oil. Probably corn oil.
It's actually soy oil.
Soy oil, okay.
It's very prevalent. Yeah. I mean, you look at salad dressings or
mayonnaise.
You know, chips, mayonnaise.
Yep.
I mean, I look at my mayonnaise and I gotta say, I love mayonnaise, but it's full of soy oil.
Get Spectrum. Spectrum Naturals is a very good brand.
Thank you. Okay.
They'll make it out of flax.
Okay.
The
great.
Sweetener will be honey.
Okay.
It tastes like mayonnaise.
Okay,
it's
great.
Very, very nice.
Okay.
That's what we use.
Well, I'm very particular about my mayonnaise, but I have to say, I really slather it on my. I made a gluten free roll up.
Mm.
You know, I get these big gluten-free flatbreads, and it's not paleo because it's derived
still
from a
grain,
but
it's
a carbohydrate. And then I put I'll put in turkey slices and tomato and lettuce and a lot of mayo.
And
I'll roll it up and I'll have a roll-up. It's a great quick
nice.
Dinner.
Yeah.
So anyway, coming back to the soybean oil story, they did a study of GMO soy oil.
Mm.
And, you know, GMO soy oil, they actually devised a soy oil which is low in linoleic acid, which is thought to be the culprit when it comes to insulin resistance.
Right.
And indeed, they found that in studies that animals fed this soy oil have less insulin resistance. Mm. But they have no metabolic advantage. They have the same risk of obesity and diabetes. In spite of the GMO engineering, they tried to engineer a healthier soy oil.
Mm-hmm.
It's just as bad as the regular soy oil.
Yeah.
So this is what, you know.
Too much omega-6.
And we're putting this into the food supply, and it's.
Yeah.
They compared it toe-to-toe with, perish the thought, coconut oil, which is pure saturated fat. I mean,
96% of it. Yep.
It looks like hair pomade.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's
yep.
it's
a glacier.
it's saturated fat to the max, and they found that that did not produce the same adverse metabolic effects.
We're not surprised.
Right. We're not surprised.
You and I.
But
yes.
The American Heart Association still says get away from those tropical oils and butter and, you know, make sure that you have 1% or skim milk and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And,
which is all wrong, unfortunately.
Right. Apropos of that, you did an article where you pointed to the hazards of milk.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Where the study was three times the risk of mortality?
Yeah. There was a Swedish study. Yeah. It was fascinating. They followed two large cohorts of men and women, and women had three times the risk of death if they drank three or more cups of milk a day, as opposed to the women who drank one cup or less.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, what was interesting is they pointed out in the article that that did not apply to cheese.
To what?
To cheese.
No, it did not. Right. Or fermented milk products.
Or fermented milk products.
Yeah.
So do we have a theory as to why that might be?
Probably the vitamin K in cheese and things like that.
Good.
Okay. In the fermented milk products, a lot of that lactose is eaten up by the beneficial bacteria, the probiotics that are in there. So you get the benefit of maybe a little less lactose than you would in milk. 3 cups of milk a day is still a lot of sugar. That's a lot of lactose. So that doesn't help.
Right. So a lot of people say, I'm going to have full-fat milk.
Hmm. It's better than skim.
What they don't realize is that that's only 4% fat.
Right.
So yeah.
They think that it's all this fat, but milk is only, dairy is only 4%.
Only 4% fat. So still, even in, quote, full-fat milk, there's a fairly high carbohydrate content.
That's right, yeah.
So really, unless you drink, you know, cream, then there's going to be relatively more fat and less carbohydrate. And there's a greater satiety value. That's why sometimes we tell our patients who like to put skim milk in their coffee, put cream in your coffee.
Put cream in it. Put half and half in it. It's less lactose. Absolutely.
And it will actually be more like, what do they call it?
It'll taste better, too.
What do they call it?
Bulletproof?
Bulletproof.
Coffee,
which is...
That's got grass-fed butter in it and coconut oil in it.
Originally from Tibet with yak butter.
With yak butter in their tea. Yak butter
but
in
that's,
the tea.
That feels like a meal because you get the caffeine, a little bit of jolt, and you get the satiety value of the fat.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so we digress. We digress before we even started. So let's start with questions.
Okay, we have a question from Marianne. How much B12 is too much B12 in the serum? What should our blood tests look like? I'm at a level of 1010 and my husband's at a level of 920. We both have methylation issues because we have the MTHFR.
Wow. Okay.
One copy. So.
Okay. So this is like a lot of doctors will test people for B12 and they'll find that lo and behold, the B12 levels in the blood are high. And they'll say, oh my goodness, stop taking B12. Your B12 levels are high.
Yeah.
But actually, I've never seen B12 toxicity, so that even people have B12 that is well over, you know, the upper limits of normal is 1,200. If it's 1,500 or 2,000, it doesn't matter. It's not a problem. So, you know, as you know, this MTHFR thing is very popular now. And what that means is that people have issues with methylating. And they require higher levels of at least 3 B vitamins, maybe more. B12, B6, and folate, but not folic acid, because folic acid gums up the works, and folic acid is in a lot of vitamins. By the way, we've reformulated our foundation formula, which is coming out in a couple of months. We've had a hiatus because of the production. We are actually going to create a foundation formula that has folate rather than folic acid, which is more bioavailable for people with MTHFR problems. So you can take enormously high levels of B12. I mean, I have some patients who have neurological disorders, and we deliberately push hard.
B12.
It's a little bit like, say you've got, I don't know, if you try to push a car uphill or something, it's going to take more effort than if you want to push a car on a level surface. That's a way to put it, is that, you know, a car might roll easily on a level surface, but you have to push harder uphill. Mm-hmm. You need to apply the pressure nutritionally with higher doses, sometimes what we term pharmacological doses, i.e. doses not necessarily found in nature, to promote those pathways so that people feel good and people have optimal cognitive function. And so I don't see that as a problem. The best B12, most bioavailable, is methyl B12. It's also the most expensive. The hierarchy of B12 is methyl's the most expensive, most bioavailable, and then there's hydroxycobalamin, which is intermediate, and then there's cyanocobalamin, which is the commercially available B12, which is less bioavailable.
Yeah.
So anyway, I don't think there's a danger of ODing on B12 here.
Don't worry about your B12, Marianne.
No.
Okay, we have another question from Kathleen. Good morning. My sister swears by the healing powers of spirulina. I have goiter, and I wonder if I could take spirulina, or will it have an adverse effect? Is it in the seaweed family?
Okay. You have spirulina. Yes, it's actually an algae.
It's an algae, yeah.
And so there's some concerns. What are some of the concerns we have about spirulina? First of all, spirulina is probably a good source of, it is actually a bit of a source of protein.
Mm-hmm.
And it is...
And probably iodine.
And iodine, and so certain minerals, B vitamins. I think it has some niacinamide or niacin in it.
Yeah.
B3. So as a plant food, it has certain unusual characteristics for a plant food. But there's some concerns. So
there are some concerns, and it has to do with why there are concerns with our seafood. It's in the water, so it can easily absorb heavy metals like lead and mercury. We have to be concerned about the environment that it's grown in.
So we have to source it properly.
We have to source it
properly.
It
has to be tested from a reliable manufacturer.
Exactly.
It's a freshwater. It's a freshwater thing, right? By the way,
it's a freshwater.
And in general, freshwater tends to, because freshwater bodies of water are smaller than oceans, and they're contained, and they take a lot of runoff from the land, they are more susceptible to pollution than something that's found in the deep blue sea.
Right, right. Sourcing, again, is important because some products have been found to contain cytotoxins, meaning, can damage your cells. So,
but there's actually a neurotoxin that occasionally, and this occurs, it's been documented in wildlife and in humans, is drinking water from lakes that are polluted with the wrong kind of algae can cause a severe neurological disease.
Yeah.
And this, I don't know that...
What's scarier is when that water goes up your nose and who knows where then?
Well, you get amoebic infections sometimes, but probably not from the commercially available spirulina. I think the Klamath Lake, which is in Oregon, is a good source because Oregon has pretty strict regulations about the quality control on that as to the toxins, the neurotoxins, the nervous system toxins that can develop in blue-green algae. So that's a real concern, but I think that there's a regulation of the industry and probably the Klamath Valley spirulina is probably good quality. It's not high on my list of supplements that I give.
Yeah, it's not high on my list either.
But
really.
It's said to have some detoxifying effects, vis-a-vis heavy metals, actually. Excuse me.
Exactly. So.
And the other thing is that, and I didn't know this because I just looked this up, is that unlike most plants, lots of spirulina can provoke high levels of uric acid. So if you have gout, you may not want to take massive amounts of it because unusual among plants, I think asparagus is another type of plant that has the potential to worsen gout. Usually vegetarian diet really helps gout, but if you subsist on spirulina, that it more has the RNA profile of animal protein.
Yeah, yeah. Spirulina also contains microcystins, which is a group of amino acids that can be toxic to the liver, which very interesting.
Yeah, that's another potential.
Moderation in everything, I think, is key here. I don't think we need to be taking boatloads of a particular supplement such as spirulina.
Right.
Bottom line.
Yeah, not a big fan.
Yeah. Okay, thank you, Kathleen, for your question. Do we have time for...
Yes, we do.
Great.
Okay, let's put
great.
Another question into part one, and then we'll pause, and
okay.
Many of our listeners will pick up on the conversation in part two.
This comes from Bob from sunny Florida. Greetings, Dr. Hoffman. I just had a CT calcium score, and it was a 25. Is there a natural approach to reduce calcium buildup to lower my score? Should I be doing chelation?
Okay, so great question, because this is a test that we use quite a lot at the Hoffman Center. And I'm really proud to say that's one of the things that I was really out front in doing when it was unpopular. And it's still to some extent discouraged because some insurance companies don't cover it, which I have no idea why.
What about that big NIH study that vindicated the benefits of...
I know. What is it? It's actually a test that doesn't so much look at blockage. It just looks at the amount of calcium that appears in a scan. And it's just, you get a score from 0 to, it could be 2,000. 2,000 being a lot of calcium, and 0 being, we can't find any calcium.
Yeah. His score is a 25.
Yeah, the 25 is relatively low.
Yeah.
Now, it depends, because...
He's 67.
So that's kind of, you know...
It's going to happen.
Better than average for 67.
Yeah.
So, also, it doesn't tell you where it is. It doesn't tell you whether you're at high risk for a blood clot that could cause a heart attack or a stroke.
Mm-hmm.
But it just tells you that you are a little bit along the lines along the way towards atherosclerosis. By the way, the scoring method was developed by a guy named Arthur Agatson,
mm-hmm.
who's the author of...
The South Beach Diet.
Interesting guy, you know. Mm-hmm. So he's got both his bona fides in terms of scientifically as a, you know, diagnostic cardiologist,
mm-hmm.
but also author of a popular book. So he's diversified his income streams for sure. the score of 25. It's also they do like an age match to what is normal, and it's actually normal and physiologic for people to have some plaque, you know, by the time they get past a certain age.
Yeah.
Now, I actually once asked Lauren Cordain this question. Lauren Cordain is the guy who developed the Paleolithic diet. And I stepped in it and I said, Dr. Cordain, I said, I bet if you study primitive peoples, they don't have any plaque scores at all, because cardiovascular disease was unknown in people eating a paleo diet. And he said, oh, no. He says, our studies show that, you know, individuals past a certain age had atherosclerosis. You know, like
The Maasai.
The Maasai, you know,
eat a lot of beef.
They also drink blood, so they have a higher. So you could explain that for them. But in the remains of people like there's this Austrian guy named Otzi who was he's probably about 45, but he was looked for all the world like an old man because life was tough in those days, 20,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And he was felled by an arrow, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
But he had arthritis, and when his coronary arteries had atherosclerosis. So to say that it's just a product of our Western diet.
Joints were inflamed, and that's more
inflammation. Right.
Yeah.
I've seen some discordances. I've seen some people who have very high scores and don't have cardiovascular disease, and I've seen some people who have low scores and have some cardiovascular disease. So the only good score, in my opinion, is a score that's in the single digits or zero. Anything above that suggests that you might be prone to cardiovascular risk. And it doesn't necessarily mean you need to be on a statin, but you should be taking precautions. So, I tell patients to follow a Mediterranean diet, low carbohydrate diet. I tell them to take the right supplements, resveratrol and chiolic H garlic extract and anti-inflammatory nutrients,
mm-hmm.
omega-3 fish oils, and so on and so on and so on. Chelation would be good as preventive, because we know that high levels of lead and mercury predispose to cardiovascular disease.
Yeah.
And we know that chelation is good for the heart. So you might undertake preventive chelation. I wouldn't do so on an emergency basis, because mm-hmm. it's not like you're hanging by a thread here.
But would it lower Bob's calcium score?
The answer is, I've watched this, the answer is no. Mm. And that disappoints a lot of people who do this. They do like 20, 30, 40, 50 chelations, and they go back, and the score's higher. But that doesn't mean that it's not working, because plaque, it's not just the quantity of plaque, it's the quality of the plaque. Plaque that is...
needs to be stable.
Stable, right. There's this notion of the stable plaque versus the jagged...
That's going to break off
or
cause an infarct.
Plaque that might be inflamed and attract platelets to it, causing a blood clot. So you know, there you have it. This is a technique that we use to, I'm pleased to say that there's so many patients I see with just really way high cholesterols, you know, 287, 301.
Yeah.
And then we do this test and we vindicate them. The test, they have zero plaque.
It's great.
You know.
So it's not all about the cholesterol.
It's certainly
for
not
so many people. So.
C-reactive protein, homocysteine, mm-hmm. LP little A, your obesity, your activity mm-hmm. levels, genes, it's a lot. All right, this is a good point at which to break. We urge you to, I was going to say flip over the LP, but the modern equivalent of it is to check out part two of today's podcast. We hope you'll join us. It's Q&A with Layla.
I have a record player.
Yeah, you have a record player.
I have two.
What's a record?
I have an old one and a new one.
Yeah. I don't know. Records.
Vinyl.
Okay. Vinyl's good. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and together today with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin. We'll be right back.